From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross. Yesterday, Dr. Jack Kevorkian helped another patient die. Today, the Netherlands legalized euthanasia. And recently, President Clinton lifted a ban on fetal tissue research. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about ethics and medicine with Dr. Arthur Kaplan. He's been called the Carl Sagan of bioethics. His new book is called If I Were a Rich Man, Could I Buy a Pancreas? Also, we talk with Professor Wu Ning Kwan about surviving imprisonment and persecution in communist China. His memoir is A Single Tear. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews two recordings of works by the turn-of-the-century black British composer Samuel Coleridge Taylor. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Haiti's military-run government said today that it will allow United Nations human rights monitors to operate freely in the country for at least a year. The announcement marked a turnaround for the military leaders who deposed President Jean-Bertrand Aristide in September of 1991. As late as last week, Haiti's rulers told UN Representative Dante Caputo that they would not accept monitors, and they reportedly berated and insulted him into the bargain. Caputo acknowledged that it's not clear whether the Haitians will cooperate with UN monitors once they're in place. President Clinton will soon make good on his campaign promise to lift the travel and immigration ban on people infected with the AIDS virus. NPR's Chitra Raghavan reports.
President Clinton has authorized the Department of Health and Human Services to remove HIV and AIDS from the list of communicable diseases that prevents travelers or immigrants from entering the United States. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued a new recommendation removing HIV from the list. That recommendation is awaiting the approval of Health and Human Services Secretary Donna Shalala. That means only infectious tuberculosis will be grounds to refuse entry into the United States. Once Shalala approves the recommendation, it will be published in the Federal Register, after which it becomes the rule. The people who will immediately feel the effects of President Clinton's action will be the 267 Haitian refugees who have been held for months at a U.S. military base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, because either they or their family members tested HIV positive. This is Chitra Raghavan in Washington.
President Clinton's advisors are nearly finished with their review of options to try to end the fighting in Bosnia. Some of them are critical of the plan promoted by Cyrus Vance and Lord Owen, the UN and European Community mediators, but they're not coming up with a radically different alternative. Barry Schweid reports.
Weighing the options, looking for ways to satisfy both the Muslims and the Serbs, and for ways to work with Cyrus Vance and Lord Owen, the president's advisors are not about to present a vastly different blueprint. They may suggest appointment of a special advisor to work with the mediators and also with the warring factions, and that means supporting what Vance and Owen have been trying to do while not endorsing their formula for 10 semi-autonomous zones in Bosnia. The president already has suggested that arrangement would be unfair to the Muslims, who account for more than 40% of the population. During the campaign, the president promised to help the Muslims, but talk of force by the United States is now being muted, and the emphasis is placed on finding an accommodation everyone can accept. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 23 points to close at 3,414.58. This is NPR. The FBI said today that a police task force has identified a suspect in the shootings that killed two CIA employees outside agency headquarters 2 weeks ago. FBI spokesman Robert Bryant told reporters that a worldwide manhunt is being launched to capture a 28-year-old Pakistani man, Mir Imal Khansi. Officials said that an AK-47 assault rifle found at Khansi's apartment in Reston, Virginia, has been confirmed as the murder weapon. During an address to the American Bar Association convention in Boston, Special Prosecutor Lawrence Walsh renewed his criticism of former President Bush for his Christmas Eve pardon of six Iran-Contra figures. David Wright of WBUR reports.
The Iran-Contra prosecutor said President Bush had abused his power by pardoning Reagan Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger and five other defendants Walsh said by pardoning Weinberger, Mr. Bush may have created the impression that he wished to avoid embarrassing disclosures about his own involvement in Iran-Contra.
What is the excuse for letting us spend millions of dollars and years of time going through this matter, and then after election, as he's about to leave office, to grant a pardon to the highest-ranking person exposed by the investigation?
Walsh also suggested he may seek one more indictment, although he declined to be specific. Some Republican leaders have accused Walsh of making outlandish charges in order to justify a costly investigation. For National Public Radio, this is David Wright in Boston.
The Justice Department is reported to be sending President Clinton a second report on allegations surrounding FBI Director William Sessions. The Associated Press quoted a Justice Department source as saying that the latest allegations focused on whether Sessions received an inappropriately favorable deal on his home mortgage. Sessions is already seeking to defend himself against earlier allegations. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane. Physician-assisted suicide is in the news again. Yesterday, Dr. Jack Kevorkian, known as the suicide doctor, helped a 47-year-old woman who had multiple sclerosis kill herself. She died in her suburban Detroit apartment by inhaling carbon monoxide, the 12th person assisted by Dr. Kevorkian. Today in the Netherlands, a new law was passed that establishes strict guidelines which allows a doctor to help a patient die. The Netherlands has the most lax euthanasia laws in the world. The thorny issue of physician-assisted suicide has confounded lawyers, hospital administrators, doctors, patients, and medical ethicists alike. Arthur Kaplan is the director of the Center for Biomedical Ethics at the University of Minnesota. He also teaches in the university's philosophy and surgery departments, and he's the author of a book of essays called If I Were a Rich Man, Could I Buy a Pancreas? It's his job to think about the current ethical issues surrounding the delivery of modern medicine.
I'd say the major issues of the day are, first, the right to die, the termination of treatment, the pulling of the plug on people who suffer from cancer or Alzheimer's or other diseases, plus the related question of, is it ever correct for the doctor to assist in death, to hurry death intentionally, a la Jack Kevorkian. Another major area is AIDS, trying to deal with the threat that the epidemic poses, not only to the health of Americans, but to privacy and confidentiality and to civil liberties. I think a third major area is what I would call reproductive technologies, trying to grapple with the ability to make babies in new ways, to use surrogate mothers, to transplant embryos, to see women in their 50s delivering babies by means of egg donation. Lots of tough questions there about the nature of motherhood, about what's in the best interest of a child, about the importance of actually having a baby, and who would get custody should a dispute break out. And the last area, and the one that I think is emerging is perhaps the most contentious of all, genetics. The new discoveries in genetics that are coming out almost every week, allowing us to pinpoint the hereditary causes of disease and also of behavior and personality. Questions such as, is homosexuality rooted in some sort of biological cause? Should we test people in the workplace for their disposition to diseases? Should insurance companies have the ability to weed people out based on their genetic makeup? That really is the 21st century bioethics frontier, and I think it's going to keep the bioethicists fully employed for some time to come.
Well, let's talk about physician-assisted suicide. Yesterday, Dr. Jack Kevorkian helped another person commit suicide. This was a woman who had MS. It's the 12th time that he has done this. Did he break any laws by helping this woman die?
Well, he didn't. Michigan has no law on the books that prohibits assisting in a suicide. More than 30 states do. Michigan is not one. The legislature has passed a law. It's very specific to Kevorkian's activities, but it doesn't take effect until April 1st. So right now, technically, he has not broken the law in assisting in these suicides.
Why haven't medical associations removed his license?
The medical association suspended Kevorkian's license, but he's appealing that. I think the reason that they haven't moved aggressively in trying to police his conduct is that there's a tremendous amount of ambivalence on the part of the medical profession. Surveys show about 20% of American physicians admit to having hurried or hastened or assisted in the death of a patient. What Kevorkian is doing in the newspaper, is doing publicly, does go on in a quiet way in many, many American hospitals with the knowing participation of both the doctor and the patient. And so I think to come down harshly on him would be seen as a bit of hypocrisy by many in the medical profession.
What is wrong from your vantage point with physician-assisted suicide? And we can talk a little bit about active euthanasia and passive euthanasia, but where's the slippery slope there?
Well, I think with respect to stopping treatments, withdrawing technology, there's nothing wrong. Patients should be in charge of what happens to them in the hospital. If you don't want dialysis, if you don't want a respirator, if you want to be allowed to die, I think that is your right, and you should have every protection of that right. And in fact, I would argue that we've moved to that position in the United States. The more controversial area is giving the doctor the authority to kill you, to actually do something intentionally that will hasten, that will cause your death. I think there are three major problems with legalizing what Dr. Kevorkian is doing. First, you're in a situation where it's not clear to me that the doctor has to kill you. We may be in a position when we're terminally ill or severely disabled where we need access to pills, where we need access to information, but I haven't yet heard the case made as to why the doctor should be the person who administers the fatal dose or the fatal injection, or in the case of Dr. Kevorkian, the fatal gas. It seems to me that doctors in this day and age are not needed, but people want to get them involved in part because it seems that they want to shift moral responsibility. And I would argue that moral responsibility for ending your own life ought to be in your own hands. Secondly, we've got a system right now, a healthcare system that has 30 million people outside it. They have no insurance. If you look and see who supports the active euthanasia movement, who it is that's in the Hemlock Society, you will find very few poor people. You will find very few people of color. They're afraid of what it would mean to allow doctors the right to kill legally in a system where they don't have the right to get into the healthcare system. Literally, the prospect is there for abuse because we can't have a system that doesn't allow people the right to healthcare but affords them the right to be killed by the doctor. The last problem, I think, is that we need some checks and balances. What Kevorkian is up to is a situation where he doesn't test the competency of the people who ask to die. He doesn't find out whether they really mean it, if their wishes are authentic. And so you've got to have some kind of checks and balances. Otherwise, you're going to attract the depressed, the despondent, people who are disturbed, not those who really do mean that they've given up and they want their lives to be ended.
Does it concern?
I won't say that I think assisted suicide is wrong in every case, but I think it's wrong in most cases, and American medicine could do a lot better job trying to teach people how to cope with illness, how to cope with dying, than it presently does. And I'd hate to let us off the hook by saying, well, look, let's just wind up killing people, rather than pushing us to make death and dying a much more acceptable and palatable experience.
Let me get your reaction to a new law in the Netherlands, which does allow doctors to assist in the suicide of a patient, or even allows them to kill a terminally ill patient if the patient requests it. There are several guidelines. One is that the request is voluntary, it's not made under pressure, that there is serious suffering with no hope of recovery. Mm-hmm. They have to express that they truly want to die, and there mm-hmm. needs to be a second opinion from a physician. Does that take care of some of the ethical issues as you see them?
It does. I think the Dutch... It's important to know that the Dutch have had decriminalized euthanasia. They haven't prosecuted physicians now for getting involved in assisting in a suicide on request of patients for about 7 or 8 years now. And so they're familiar with it, and this is basically a shift to make what's been going on legal. I think the Dutch have put in checks and balances. They are checking to make sure that the person is mentally stable. They do require a diagnosis of terminal illness that's confirmed by someone other than the doctor who's going to assist in the suicide. They are saying that they want the person to indicate over a sustained period of time that they mean it, that it's not just an expression of despair at a particular moment. I think those are reasonable checks and balances, and they handle many of the ethical problems. The other thing that's true of Holland is no one is seeking out assistance in suicide because they fear that they're going to go broke, because they're worried about spending out their relative's estate, because they feel the pressure of cost containment. That's not true in the United States. And so in that sense, I think the Dutch situation is not analogous to ours. The Dutch have national health insurance. The Dutch are not going to the doctor to be killed because they want to conserve their bank balance, because they fear that they won't be able to pay for the care. They go there when they feel that they really don't want to suffer, or they don't want to go through the indignity of the dying process. That wouldn't be true in the United States until we get our healthcare system into some kind of decent, minimally decent shape.
Arthur Kaplan is the director of the Center for Biomedical Ethics at the University of Minnesota and the author of If I Were a Rich Man, Could I Buy a Pancreas? More on medical ethics after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to bioethicist Arthur Kaplan. Does it concern you that most of Dr. Kevorkian's patients have been women?
Yes, it does. I've commented on the fact in print a couple of times and written that I'm very bothered that the overwhelming majority of the people, not only who he has assisted but who've contacted him, have been middle-aged women. I think these are people who feel that life has nothing more to offer them. They're frequently people whose children have moved away, who don't have jobs, who find themselves facing chronic illness and sometimes with pain, and they feel abandoned. And it just strikes me as a horrendous indictment of our society if the best we can offer to people who are suffering not terminal illness, none of the very few, not none, but very few of the women who Kevorkian has helped have been terminally ill. Some have had Alzheimer's, some have had chronic pain. Is it really the situation that we want to offer as a society to make life worthwhile for women? Kevorkian's Thanatron, Kevorkian's carbon monoxide mask, I think that doesn't speak well of America.
But this interest in the right to die and an impatient's right to die, does that express a concern in this country, a kind of flip side express from what concern from what you have said, that many times people feel that it's difficult to die in this country. Once you get put into a hospital, it's difficult to get off life support system. It's difficult to argue for what you want once you're in a hospital.
Well, I think that clinical practice is changing with respect to being in control of life support, of all the machines and the technology. I think even 5 years ago, when we heard about cases like Cruzan and Busalaki and Quinlan, that we were frightened and worried that we would be trapped and imprisoned in horrible states, maybe left to suffer, and that the easier way out would be to just have ourselves killed or dispatched. I think that medicine has made some progress on that score and is now in a position to say, no, no, you can say that you've had enough of the respirator or you want your feeding tube turned off. We've had Supreme Court decisions that affirm those rights. Nevertheless, is the appearance of a strong right to die movement, the popularity and support for Kevorkian, the state initiatives in California and Washington that attracted more than 40% voter turnout in support of the right to let doctors assist in suicide, is that an indictment of American medicine? You bet. It's telling us that we don't deal adequately with pain, that we have too many people dying in hospitals, that people are cut off from family and friends by a system that is basically inept at dealing with dying. I would argue that the solution, however, is not to go out and kill people. For most individuals, the solution is to make a humane, caring system that gives options, that allows one more access to hospice, that allows one to go home, that allows one adequate pain relief, that allows one to have a dignified death without being forced to go into fiscal bankruptcy. This society can do those things. The danger is, as we all yammer on about cost containment and the need to get a handle on escalating healthcare costs, that we're not going to think carefully about doing that because the right to die looks like a quick, easy, simple, and efficient way to solve these problems of terminal illness and dying. But I would argue, as Mencken once said, it looks easy, it looks simple, it's just wrong.
Well, you're really describing the problems with the system, and we have a $800 billion a year healthcare system in this country.
$940 billion.
Okay, and counting, obviously, $940 billion. But does that tell you that in order to get a system that is more humane, is it going to cost more money, or does it actually cost less money?
It could cost less money. The fact is, having the overwhelming number of Americans that we have dying in hospitals, more than a million a year out of the roughly 1.5 million who die every year, dying in acute care settings and hospital settings and intensive care units is madness. And it is fueled by a system that has reimbursed doctors for doing the most. It is fueled by a system that only pays if you're in the hospital. We've got a system that is out of whack. It's basically, to use a Yiddish term, it's severely meshuggah. You find people
crazy, right?
Told that when they're severely ill, they have to stay in an ICU bed. They have to remain there even if they're comatose. This is craziness. We're not using our nursing home options. We're not using sufficient long-term care options. We're not sending people home to die as we should. We're not pushing the hospice option as we should, and we're not paying for any of these things. What we've got is a system that says we'll pour resources into you as long as you get the most intensive, aggressive care possible in a hospital. And should you try to get away from that system and have basically supportive care and palliative care, well, that's not reimbursable. I mean, that's just craziness.
Does that tell you something about how Americans feel about death, about illness, about suffering and discomfort, the system that we have in place now?
I think it does. I think the system we have in place now tells us quite a bit about death. It tells us that we don't like it. It tells us that we've made it a stranger. It tells us that we've pushed it out of our homes and into institutionalized settings where we can't see it anymore. And it tells us that we've transferred responsibility and authority to people in white coats. If you ask the average minister or rabbi or priest, what do you know about hospice? What can you say about home care? How can you help families with dying members? I'm ashamed to say that most of these people will not have any idea of how to deal with dying. They view it as something for doctors, as something for hospitals, as something for science. We're a society that, as much as we say we don't want technology and we fear being imprisoned by it, we've wrapped ourselves in it as a way to cope with the fact that we basically want to deny death. We want to deny the fact that we can't keep ourselves vigorous and healthy forever.
What is the connection between this attitude towards death and also our legal system and the fact that so much of the medicine that's being practiced is defensive medicine for fear of some kind of a lawsuit?
Well, one of the things that I've been interested in looking at in recent years is what does the influence of the current legal system and malpractice system do to the practice of medicine in terms of both defensive practice and cost? And the verdict that I've come up with is nothing good. We have a system that is basically saying, look, if you don't do a test, if you don't do things that are of marginal utility or even stretching the imagination on the borders of absurdity, you doctor, you nurse, are liable. And we are going to make you liable for not doing everything possible to detect illness or to try and treat it. At the same time, we've got a legal system that operates as something akin to a national lottery. If you have a child born with any kind of damage, why not file a lawsuit and see if you can get some compensation? If you have any kind of bad outcome in a case, you almost always see some sort of legal proceeding start. We need to go to a system that basically takes matters of malpractice and misconduct and puts them both to mandatory arbitration and has some sort of caps on the amount of settlement that can be obtained when there's been an injury or damage. If we had a national healthcare system, we wouldn't have to go to the legal system to allow people to get the money to pay for whatever it will cost to compensate them for damage or injury or disability that they suffered. The legal system that we've got now is having a horrendous effect on our costs. It is not bringing anybody justice. Many people win, but many people lose when they should have come out victorious. And it's not eliminating either bad medical practice or outright misconduct. So I'd say we pay a lot for a legal system that doesn't serve any good in terms of social goals.
How much do you think all these technological changes, and even that the medical system that we have now, is changing the relationship between patient and doctor?
It's changing the relationship between patient and doctor quite a bit. When I go on rounds now, ethics rounds, at the University of Minnesota Hospital, it's interesting for me to watch how little time is spent by the doctor in a patient's room. My sort of mental clock says that the average visit is about the same as length of time as the average network soundbite. The doctor comes in, basically spends 20 seconds or less chatting with or talking with the patient, and relies on the technology, the testing, the diagnostic interventions to get the information that he or she wants. Much less talk, much more readout of computer printouts, of various sorts of machines that spit out all kinds of information about the biochemical status of the individual. So we're slowly replacing bedside manner with a kind of distance, having the doctors in communication with the machines. And there's been no attempt to replace this emerging gap in doctor-patient relationships with anything human, with any kind of continuity of communication or care. If you go to a large medical center, I think if you ask most individuals there, they'd have a hard time identifying who exactly it is that is their doctor, because so many specialists come along to manage this technology that it's not clear who's responsible for the patient.
As we move towards a more managed healthcare system, do you see that is going to further erode the relationship between patient and doctor?
Well, I'm worried about that. I know that the proponents of managed healthcare, the idea that we should have health plans that assign us a doctor and assign us to particular hospitals or clinics, believe that this will save money. But that doesn't get to one of the major failings of our healthcare system, the lack of having an identified primary care provider who can act as your advocate. The idea behind managed care is, in fact, to take away choice from the individual patient and basically run the person through the system using the doctor as a gatekeeper, so that you don't have an advocate. You have someone who, in some sense, is almost adversarial to you. I think that you can do managed care without getting involved in those kind of arrangements, but many managed care plans are not addressing this problem of the doctor-patient, nurse-patient alliance. They're simply paying attention to the bottom line of healthcare and not worrying very much about what it means to have good quality care.
I'm going to ask you a question and I'm going to need a soundbite answer. How much should a patient know about their doctor? And I'm talking, of course, about doctors who test positive for the AIDS virus.
I think patients have a right to know everything that is materially relevant about their doctor. If the doctor is going to do surgery on you, you probably have a right to know their HIV status. If the doctor is your psychiatrist, you don't.
And if the doctor is going through a divorce, you need to know that? Or if they didn't get a good night's sleep?
I think if your, let's put it this way, if your fellow surgeon would want to know whether that divorce or that loss of sleep was affecting the person's competence, you would too. What we really need to know, though, is the outcomes that that surgeon has had or that psychiatrist has had over the past year. We need the consumer reports of healthcare, and that basic information is where we ought to put our emphasis in terms of disclosure about what doctors and hospitals do.
And very briefly, do you feel that the system is going to change? Is there movement towards change?
There is some movement. I think doctors and nurses are fed up with the system. I think patients are fed up, and I think business is fed up. Ironically, the locus of change is probably coming from a kind of corporate socialism, corporate boardroom socialism. The cost is too high. Business and the third-party payers want some change, and I think that political alliance will produce some change. I hope for the good, as long as we keep the consumer firmly in mind. I think it'll go that way.
Arthur Kaplan, thank you for joining us on Fresh Air.
My pleasure.
Arthur Kaplan is the director of the Center for Biomedical Ethics at the University of Minnesota. He teaches in the university's philosophy and surgery departments. He's also got a book of essays called If I Were a Rich Man, Could I Buy a Pancreas? I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen with Fresh Air. Wu Ning-Quan spent 3 decades in and out of prison under the Chinese communist regime. His crime? He was labeled a counter-revolutionary for teaching American literature and introducing the Chinese to American writers like F. Scott Fitzgerald and John Steinbeck. Coming up, we talk with Wu Ning-Quan about his new memoir, A Single Tear. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews 2 newly released recordings of the work of Samuel Coleridge Taylor, a black British composer from the turn of the century who was influenced by Dvorak and American spirituals. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton has announced that he will be cutting the size of the White House staff by 25%. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The president ran on a platform of leaner government, but now the cuts have acquired a new urgency, making good on his promise as being described by the president himself as a signal to the American people that the government won't ask them to do anything it isn't willing to do itself. In just a little over a week, President Clinton will lay out a program of deficit reduction that includes spending cuts and tax hikes. Today, he said that by the beginning of the next fiscal year, the White House staff will be reduced to 1,044 employees. 350 fewer than President Bush had on board on Election Day. In addition, salaries will be cut 6 to 10%, and White House perks will be curtailed. Door-to-door limousine service for top officials will be cut in half. The exclusive White House mess will be open to all employees, and newspaper and magazine subscriptions will be cut back. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
Police in Fairfax, Virginia, have issued an arrest warrant for a 28-year-old man in connection with the fatal shootings recently of 2 CIA employees outside the agency's headquarters. The suspect has been identified as Mir Amal Khansi, a Pakistani national who lived in Reston, Virginia. The warrant charges the suspect with capital murder and unlawful flight in connection with the January 25th shootings. Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler have decided they will not file a complaint with the Commerce Department charging that the Japanese are dumping automobiles in the U.S. market. NPR's John Idsty reports.
There had been speculation that the Big Three would file a complaint on Friday. It would have been the largest case of its kind in U.S. history. But this afternoon, in a telephone conference call, the chief executive officers of Ford, GM, and Chrysler decided against filing a complaint. Afterward, the CEOs said in a statement that they were choosing not to act now, despite the fact that their lawyers say they have a strong case against the Japanese, who are accused of selling cars at unfairly low prices in the United States. The CEOs said they were encouraged by pledges from the Clinton administration that it intends to address the big trade imbalance between the United States and Japan. The Japanese currently hold 27% of the U.S. car market, down from 30% a year ago. I'm John Idsty in Washington.
Russian President Boris Yeltsin appears to be offering a compromise to hardline lawmakers in Moscow. The Russian leader has offered to drop a call for a referendum on which branch of government should have more power, his office or that of the Russian parliament. He has been engaged in a fight with hardliners who oppose his market reforms. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 23 points to close at 3,414.58, on volume of 233 million shares. This is NPR News. Financial officials of the Group of Seven Nations plan to meet in London later this month. Several financial ministers of the leading industrialized countries have been pushing for a meeting to consider slow economic growth around the world, Russian aid, and exchange rates. The London meeting is considered a lead-up to the spring meeting of the International Monetary Fund in Washington in late April. Opponents of raising the federal gasoline tax are urging President Clinton to take a close look at who it hits, claiming that such an increase is regressive, regionally unfair, and inflationary. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
A broad range of special interest groups is hoping to influence President Clinton as he considers some kind of energy tax. Consumers, farmers, truckers, and manufacturers all warned the president today that balancing the budget at the gas pump is unfair and unpopular. Across town, industry leaders debated whether the president should choose a gas tax, a broad energy consumption tax, a carbon tax, or an oil import fee. The only consensus that emerged is to cut spending instead. A new poll released today confirmed that Americans are not in favor of a specific gas tax, but pollster Celinda Lake says people are quick to change their position.
Depending on what outcome is specified, are looking for taxes that include in it energy, modifying energy behavior, environmental behavior, and reducing the deficit.
The president is expected to include some form of energy tax in his economic package due to be unveiled February 17th. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
According to a real estate trade group, property values moved up in most parts of the country in the final quarter of last year. The National Association of Realtors says that there were exceptions to higher property values in both California and parts of the Northeast. The median price of a home in the Midwest was up 5.5% and 4.3% in the South. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Wu Ningquan was born in Yangsu, China. He came to the States in the 40s to go to college and graduate school. In 1951, soon after the Communist Revolution in China, he received an invitation to return to his country to teach English and American literature. He eagerly took the offer, hoping that the new government would modernize the country and improve the lives of its people. He found when he returned that the old feudal system had been abolished, and some of the outward signs of poverty and corruption were gone. But soon communists began rooting out anyone who disagreed or differed with their ideology. Wu was denounced as a counter-revolutionary, and over the next 30 years was sent to several prison and labor camps. He's written a memoir about how he and his family survived these experiences entitled A Single Tear. In the mid-50s, a campaign for thought reform came to the campus where Wu was teaching. I asked him if he was scared.
A little, not too much, because they did everything with a certain restraint. They singled out the leaders of the university and the professors, which they considered reactionary, but just made the rest make a public confession.
What did you confess?
Oh, I confess I wasted all my good years studying bourgeois literature abroad, why the Chinese people were fighting for liberation and the leadership of the Communist Party. And I had also served with the nationalists.
Did you think you were in danger?
No, I did not think I was in danger at the time. I suppose I did not feel I was guilty of anything. And I was a recent returnee. I suppose unconsciously, I expected them to show some kind of leniency towards me.
Now, you were taken to a correction center, the Beijing Municipal Detention Center for Corrective Education through Labor, and this was in April of 1958. Leading up to that, were the condemnations that you had to withstand, were they getting worse and worse? Did you really feel, before you were taken to the center, that you were in deep trouble?
Oh, yes. I was already condemned as an ultra-rightist. I was dishonored but discharged and was condemned to thought reform through hard labor.
Now, you were taken to the Beijing Municipal Detention Center. Mm. Describe what that center was like.
This center is a sort of staging area. From there, we were sent to separate thought reform camps.
Well, you were sent to a labor reform camp, and you worked from sunrise to sunset. Now, what were the conditions like at this camp?
It's not so bad, I would say. It's not so bad. We had enough to eat, and the working hours are long, but there was no beating or even verbal abuse.
How did you keep your sanity?
Well, that's a good question. Perhaps because, for one thing, since my mother had killed herself when I was a small boy, I unconsciously decided not to follow in her footsteps. I had a kind of immunity in that sense. But then I had time to think and to reflect on life and on the human values of life. So I thought I would hold on to the human values while undergoing the punishment.
Well, I want to talk more about that, but first I want to take a very short break. And my guest on Fresh Air is Wu Ning Kwan, and we're talking about a book he's written called A Single Tear. It's a memoir about his life in China under the communist regime. He returned to China in 1951 after being educated in the States. He was denounced and imprisoned, and we're talking about his experiences there. We're going to take a very short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Wu Ning Kwan. Now, just to kind of complete the story before we get to the Cultural Revolution, after this labor reform camp, you were moved even to another one, which you described as a castle-like monstrosity. And it was really at this camp that you said you felt you lived the life of a socialist prisoner. How was this worse than the other places you were sent to?
Because the so-called discipline was much more strict, and none of the officers ever showed us a smile, and we were not allowed of the castle unless accompanied by the guards, and there was so little food.
Were you nearly starved to death?
Yes. It was the worst time in China too.
Did you think that this was going to be the way your life was going to be, that you were going to spend the rest of your life in labor camps?
I never lost hope, strangely. I thought sooner or later I would be laid out. There would be an end to it. Oh, the worst part of my experience during that period was you never knew when this would come to an end. Because they have that unbeatable logic that say, well, when you are thoroughly reformed, you would be released. And when you are released, that's an indication that you have been thoroughly reformed.
And yet you never knew what...
You never know. So.
But how were you able to keep your hope up? What kept that alive?
I suppose because of my family ties, my wife's unwavering love and support. And my love of life, my love of man, and my love of freedom, I thought, I have to live for this. They can kill me, but I will never kill myself.
Well, you were finally let out of this prison. Did you then say to yourself, well, I must have been reformed?
No. I knew I wasn't reformed. Of course, I kept telling them that I was reformed, yeah. and they also believed it, well, maybe with a grain of salt. But that was the way life was conducted in China.
You write that in 1965, you felt a, quote, ominous cloud gathering
on the cultural scene, and this is really a description of the coming cultural revolution. How did you feel things changing in China?
At the time, of course, I was afraid. But on the other hand, I wasn't too afraid because I knew I had not committed any new crimes. And the new campaign, it seems, was targeted at other people. I was already down and out. In China, I was classified as a dead tiger.
Meaning you paid the price, you were inconsequential?
That's right. Uh-huh. But then, of course, when the campaign did come, they said, well, the dead tiger is not quite dead.
Well, that's when you were called a cow demon.
Yes. Uh-huh.
What did that mean?
That means we were the we were enemies of the people.
How then did re-education programs under the Cultural Revolution, how did that affect you and your life?
Well, I was sent to the countryside at the end. Of course, not much thought reform was ever attempted during the Cultural Revolution. It was all punishment. When I was sent to the countryside, I did get some re-education through living among the peasants because although I had lived among petty criminals at the labor camp, but not the genuine peasants of China. So I got a new feeling for the peasants, for China. And I came to love China even more.
So the Cultural Revolution for you was not as dangerous then as the times preceding it when you were imprisoned.
That's right. Yes, in a way, it wasn't quite. Although we had been sent to the countryside, and there was talk about never letting us go back to the city or universities again. That's one of the Red Guards told me. He said, "Well, I don't think you or your wife Li Kai could ever come back to university again. So, but look after yourself and bring up the children." I said, "Well, I don't feel all that pessimistic."
So the life for you then, as the Cultural Revolution ended and you stayed in China, you were able to live a quote-unquote normal life?
Yes, yeah, fairly normal.
Were you able to predict the Tiananmen Square uprising? Were you surprised by that at all?
Not altogether, because I was in hospital at the time, so I had telephone conversations with some of my good friends, and towards mid-May, I said, "Uh-oh, it looks like a repeat of the anti-rightist campaign." So my friend, who was also an ex-rightist, he said, "Oh no, this can't be, because you know the euphoria was so high in Beijing." And when Tiananmen happened, so he called me again. He said, "Damn it, you are right."
But dissidents have still been prosecuted. The government is still in control. What has changed, you think, about China?
A look at economic reform, which is changing the ways of life in China. And even the dissidents, the major dissidents are now in the United States and in Paris. The government has done things differently. Well, before, people like the dissidents were never allowed to leave the country. But now they encourage them to leave the country.
Do you think that the work of the dissidents and the speaking that they've done, does that information get back into China through faxes and satellite dishes and all the...
No, I think through secret channels.
Are you still able to go back and forth to China?
I don't know. Because I don't know whether the book will make any difference, but I don't think it will make too much difference. This is, I've said nothing very strong against the present regime. This is a historical work.
But you obviously have some concerns about whether the book will prevent you from going back.
I'm not in the habit of worrying about tomorrow. I read the Bible.
Your writings were banned for a while in China?
My translations. I did not write too many things. My translations were banned after I was denounced as a rightist.
So are you going to try to go back to China?
Yeah. Yes, I belong to China.
So you'll know, I guess, when you try to make that trip back to China, whether your book has made a difference or not?
Yes. Yes, I'll wait and see. At least I don't have time to worry about tomorrow now.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Wu Ningquan's memoir is called A Single Tear. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Robert Siegel has joined us to tell us about the show today. Robert, what news stories do you have for us?
Well, news that Haiti has decided to admit human rights inspectors, that from a United Nations envoy recently returned. Also, we'll have news of President Clinton's announcement that there'll be some cuts of the White House staff and fewer top officials will have limousine service to work than had in the past. We'll also have news of a Michigan court's ruling that General Motors may not shut down its Willow Run assembly plant. And Los Angeles prepares for possible violence as two trials begin, both involving the beating of Rodney King.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. One of the most delightful composers of semi-classical music is the turn-of-the-century black British composer Samuel Coleridge Taylor, who died of pneumonia in 1912 at the age of 37. He's still better known in England than in this country, although his most popular work was Hiawatha, an oratorio based on Longfellow. Two discs devoted to Coleridge Taylor have recently been released, and classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review.
There are times when my brain gets tired and I don't feel up to Bach, Beethoven, or Mahler. That's when I'm happy for composers like Samuel Coleridge Taylor, whose music makes up in craft, inventiveness, and charm what it lacks in daring ambition. Two new compact discs show his music off to good advantage. The British Pearl label has a selection of historical recordings from the 1920s and 30s. Here's the British baritone Peter Dawson, who was an institution unto himself. He sings Sons of the Sea, a setting of a poem by the Indian poet Mrs. Sarafini Naidu.
Rise, brothers, rise, awakening skies, pray to the morning light. The wind lies asleep in the arms of the deep, like a child that has cried all night. Come, let us gather our nets on the shore and set our catamarans free to capture the leaping wealth of the tide. For we are the sons of the sea.
In Coleridge Taylor's music, you can hear the influence of Dvorak, his favorite composer, spirituals, and turn-of-the-century impressionism. A new disc on Koch International includes the most serious piece on these new albums, a melodic but rather conventional half-hour-long quintet for clarinet and strings, with clarinetist Harold Wright and the Hawthorne String Quartet. I prefer Coleridge Taylor's unabashedly romantic Petite Suite de Concert, his best-known orchestral work. The delightful and adventurous Virginia Eskin plays a piano arrangement. This is from the second movement, Demande et Réponse. Coleridge Taylor was the son of an Englishwoman and an African doctor from Sierra Leone. His music made him a hero and role model for black families on both sides of the Atlantic. There was even a Coleridge Taylor Society in this country, and in 1904 he made his first American visit at their invitation. He first heard American spirituals when the Fisk Jubilee Singers visited England in 1890. The highlight of the Koch disc is Virginia Eskin playing Spirituals, a series of understated yet richly imaginative piano settings of six familiar and unfamiliar songs. Here's a passage from the Deep River movement. Avril Coleridge Taylor's book about her father, she narrates an incident in which he was especially upset by a newspaper report about a public lecture on the Negro problem in North America. He wrote a scathing letter to the newspaper in which he repeats the reply of Alexander Dumas to an arrogant little white man who had remarked on his Negro blood. "Yes, my father was a mulatto, his father a Negro, and his father a monkey. My ancestry," Dumas says, "began where yours ends." Somehow, Coleridge Taylor concludes, "I always remember that wonderful answer when I meet a certain type of white man, a type, thank goodness, as far removed from the best as the poles from each other. And the remembrance makes me feel quite happy, wickedly happy, in fact." This story suggests the moral strength of a composer whose music doesn't often contend with moral issues.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, with Joan Tuohy, Sue Weinstein, and Roberta Shorrock. Research assistance from Chris McMahon. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Marty Moskowain.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, meet actor and director Bill Duke. His new film, The Cemetery Club, is about three Jewish widows. Duke is black, but he doesn't think race should matter in filmmaking. I'm Marty Moskowain, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.